Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Around 70 miles north of Crete lies the small volcanic island of Thera, today known as Santorini. Around 1600 BCE, or 3600 years ago, a catastrophic volcanic eruption disrupted the tranquility of the ancient Mediterranean. An unparalleled eruption of the volcano in Thera led to a cataclysmic event that buried the ancient Minoan town of Akrotiri in Santorini. The settlement was buried beneath meters of thick ash and pumice, which, thankfully to us, preserved it for our eyes. And with that, we have many frescoes that depict women gathering saffron flowers or crocus flowers, which is one of our earliest depictions of saffron in history. Hello! This is the Delicious Legacy Podcast. Welcome back to another archaeogastronomical adventure with me, Thomas Dinas. On today's episode, we are continuing with our theme of spices, and we explore one of the most valuable spices out there, a spice that comes from the stamen of a flower, the crocus flower. With its unique vibrant color and difficulty to grow in any large quantities because it comes from delicate flowers and needs to be dried and it's hand-picked, it's a very, very expensive commodity and always has been. Sam Bilton is a food historian and author of the book Fool's Gold, A History of British Saffron. And I know her for many years now. We've been following each other on Twitter since the beginning of this podcast, really, since 2019. And she was one of the first people I started following. We've been in touch since then. And I'm really happy to have her on the podcast talking about her book. Now, she's written two more books. The first one was First Cut Your Gingerbread. The latest one is The Philosophy of Chocolate, which she's going to tell us a bit more later on in the podcast. But before we go to our podcast proper, I would like to thank all of my Patreon backers so far for the help and support and making this podcast happen. And if you'd like to be one of them and help us grow, why don't you join us on Patreon from $3 a month, where you get the podcasts early and ad-free. Also, I would like to add that this podcast can only grow with your generous support. So please share the podcast far and wide with friends and family, and also leave us a review on Spotify, on Apple Podcasts, and of course on Acasts and Pocket Casts and wherever else you get your podcast from. It's really, really important that you leave a rating and a review, so that will be then suggested and mangled by the algorithms and get distributed to many people who have similar interests. So yeah, thank you all so far. And please get in touch if you have any questions about historical food, about ancient recipes, about anything that we discussed in the podcast the past few months. And of course, I will try and either answer your questions or make an episode about something that you have in mind and all that. I'm on Twitter, or X as it's called now, unfortunately. I'm there, so you can contact me there as The Delicious Legacy. or you can also email me at thedeliciouslegacypodcast@gmail.com. And of course, you can find also the podcast on YouTube, where I also have got some videos with recipes recreated in modern style. And yeah, you can either comment there, or you can get in touch any other way you like, basically. You can also follow the podcast on Patreon. You don't have to be a subscriber, and you can ask questions there too. So yeah, let's go to our podcast proper now. As I said earlier in the introduction, thanks to the volcanic eruption in Santorini, the Minoan frescoes from Akrotiri, but also from Knossos in Crete, they depict women picking saffron. And also in Knossos we have monkeys also picking saffron. So we do know there is a long history in the ancient Mediterranean world regarding saffron. By Roman time, saffron was burned in sacrifice. It was also mixed with sweet wine, and the resulting sticky yellow mixture was sprayed liberally into the air at theatres and circuses, a custom alluded to by Martial and others. Saffron was also used in an aromatic hair oil, crocinum. This was made at Soli near Corycus and also in the island of Rhodes, an important trading hub in the ancient world, midway through, obviously, Asia and Greece and communicating with the two halves of the Roman Empire. Typical additives included wine and two other plant dyes, cinnabaris, which is called dragon's blood, Dracaena cinnabari, and anchusa, to adjust the color. In the ancient times, Cilicia in southeastern Asia Minor, a region with coastal plains and mountains, was the most famous for saffron. It was grown there, in the limestone depression of Corycus, watered by an underground river. The myth of Crocus from ancient Greece, of course, is very interesting as well, and it tells us about the god Hermes accidentally killing his mortal friend Crocus. In his sadness and despair, he decided to give immortality to Crocus by transforming his soulless body into a beautiful mauve flower. And then the blood of Crocus in the three red stamens in the heart of the flower. And every autumn, the flowers of Crocus, they fill the earth. We do have a passage from Homer, which gives us a description of Crocus as well, but no more details how it was used. Much later on, around the 6th and 7th centuries, the Arabs, with their spread across the Mediterranean, North Africa and Spain, they took with them the saffron flower and they spread its cultivation across Spain. And from there, there was a regular trading with the French and the rest of Europe. So we know that saffron comes from somewhere in the near Middle East and Greece, and it's a specific flower. And also I know that in modern Greece now we have saffron, a specific organic saffron from which has been cultivated near Kozani in north of Greece, central northwest Greece, near where I'm from. And the place is called Crocos Kozanis, and produces the saffron there. But it hasn't been always the case, really. We know that this specific cultivation in Greece started with local merchants from Kozani that they actually traded with Austria, and they brought the cultivation of saffron from Austria around the 17th century. So that's a general overview of the long history of saffron, but let's find out a lot more from Sam Bilton. Enjoy. Sam Bilton, welcome to the Delicious Legacy podcast.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Great to see you again and talk about saffron and spices in general. But yeah, specifically about saffron. Why? Because you wrote a book recently about saffron.
I did.
So before we go into detail about it and what is it about and all that, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself? who are you? What about food and cooking and your books and so on?
Wow. Okay. Where to start? Okay. So I'm a food historian, but I came into this quite late, you could say. I went back to school after I had my kids and I studied culinary arts at the University of Brighton and decided from there, initially I went with a view to becoming a food writer because I really wanted to write about food. I'd written a lot in my previous existence when I worked in marketing and sort of public relations. But I decided that I really wanted to concentrate on food history because it's been a passion. I guess it was a hobby, I suppose, initially, from way back when my grandmother gave me a copy, a really beaten up copy of Mrs. Beaton's cookery book. It's not even the full household management. And inside there was a handwritten notebook. It's a very small thing from her great aunt Emma, who was passed on to then great aunt Emma passed it on to her daughter, Eliza. And then eventually it came back to my grandmother. We don't know how. My grandmother doesn't know how. She's had it forever and a day. So, and that sort of inspired me because it's quite a simple thing and very few instructions on how to cook anything, but lots of sort of recipe notes. And I have done a bit of research. And we now know that both Eliza and Emma had worked in service. So I assume it was a legacy from that and that both women have written in it. And it just, I suppose that just sparked that interest in me that I wanted to get into food history. And I've been doing that ever since.
Brilliant. Fascinating. It's a very interesting way of thinking about it, really. So you wrote a book before Saffron, right?
Yes. My first book was called First Catch of Gingerbread, which was on the history of gingerbread. And that was, again, something I've always loved spices. So it was, I think I just thought, why has no one written a book, a dedicated book in Britain on the history of gingerbread? Well, not to my knowledge, one didn't exist. And I sort of pitched the idea to Prospect Books and Catherine liked it and said, yeah, go ahead and write it. And then COVID hit. So it didn't end up being quite the same book as I envisaged it being at the start of the process. I had hoped to travel into Europe and go to places like Tehran in Poland and some parts of the Netherlands and Germany. And none of that happened, obviously, because of the pandemic.
I see. But the book is out.
The book is out. I did write the book. I mean, luckily, the focus was on British gingerbread, but I had also planned to travel around Britain as well. So again, I couldn't do that. So a lot of it I had to rely on secondary sources. And then my travelling happened latterly. I eventually got to Grasmere and queued up at Sarah Nelson's shop and bought my Grasmere gingerbread. And it's quite a feat because it was a long journey to taste a particular type of gingerbread, but I'm glad I made it in the end.
Great, fantastic. So after the gingerbread came saffron. So basically the subject of our conversation today, your book Fool's Gold.
Yes.
A history of British saffron, yeah. So why Fool's Gold?
Why the title Fool's Gold? If do you want the, I should make up an answer for this, shouldn't I? The truthful answer is it's the title of one of my favourite songs, and I thought it would work well, and it was a working title.
Brilliant.
And I kind of assumed that Catherine would make me pick something different, but she liked it as well. So yes, I really like Fool's Gold by the Stone Roses, so I used it as a working title. Great. And it stuck.
great answer.
That's the truthful answer. I never know whether you're supposed to be wholly truthful with these things, but that is the genuine God's honest truth in this case.
Well, I'll keep it for myself. I won't say to anybody. Promise.
It's a great track, great. By the way, if anyone hasn't heard it.
Yeah, good call. So obviously, talking about food and history and all that stuff, do you have a favourite historical recipe? Perhaps something that you can share with us?
This is a problem, isn't it? It's a bit like picking your favourite child, really, isn't it? It depends what mood I'm in. And I know you probably get told that a lot by your guests, but it really does. In terms of savoury foods, again, because of my love of spices, I am particularly drawn to 19th century curries, but when they're done well, not the bad ones. Not the ones that combine sort of bog standard curry powder with lots of flour and a gloopy. But if you, there are a few recipe books out there from the 19th century where, and I'm talking now about the English interpretation of curry or Indian food, so they're not by any stretch of the imagination authentic. But there is one book called, rather unimaginatively, The Indian Cookery Book. And that has, I think it dates from originally 1881, and that has some wonderful recipes in it. The korma that's in there actually did end up in the saffron book, funny enough, is absolutely beautiful, really lovely. I can't speak for its authenticity compared to a korma back in sort of India, but in terms of an English take or British take on that cuisine, there's some lovely recipes in there. So that is one of my favourite recipes. I wouldn't say it's my absolutely, like, I haven't got any other favourites, but if you had to, if I had to pick one right now, that's one that springs to mind.
Yeah, fair enough. I mean, obviously, it depends with the occasion, as you said, you know.
Yeah.
Moods change, things you want to do. So, obviously, we're going to talk about saffron today. And one of the things that I remember, I don't know why it stuck to my mind. So, Saffron Walden, the place, the town in Essex. I think it was either when I was traveling to go to Thansted Airport, perhaps.
Yes, probably.
Or
yeah.
some other reason, because I like maps and I look at maps a lot. And I saw the name Saffron Walden, and obviously sounded a little bit exotic in terms of like the sound of it. I like the sound, the word saffron and Walden together. They sound great to my ears. But also saffron, I'm come from, obviously, you know, I'm come from Greece, but the North Greece where I'm from, near, I'm from Veria, there's a town called Kozani where they grow crocus, the flower crocus, and they do saffron. And they have one of the best, apparently, saffrons in the world. So when I saw that, I was like, saffron in England? Why? What happened? What's in Saffron Walden? And
well, it's interesting because Saffron Walden didn't actually start off life as Saffron Walden. It used to be called Chepping Walden, and Chepping is the old term for a market. So that's where the name came from. And it, sort of over time, it's been hard to pinpoint, really. Other historians have tried in the past. So there was a lady called Dorothy Cromarty, and she did a lot of research into the town's saffron past. And she found references to saffron in the court rolls from the 1420s, I think. And that's sort of the first official reference. But there's no sort of indication of how the saffron was used. Now, they did have a large sheep industry in that area, for a wool industry, I should say. So there were a lot of sheep in the area and the wool was being produced. And so she has made the connection, in her mind, she believed that the sheep or the wool was being dyed with perhaps saffron. And that's why the town eventually, saffron, the market became a place where you could buy saffron. So there was a lot of saffron grown in and around Saffron Walden, which is now situated in North Essex. So it's on the border of Cambridgeshire. And actually, if you look over the board in the records in Cambridgeshire, that it was grown widely in Cambridgeshire too. So the town just became associated with the spice. And eventually in, I think about 1514, Henry VIII granted the town a charter to change its name from Chepping Walden to Saffron Walden. And then they've got a new sort of coat of arms, or I don't really call it a coat of arm, crest or whatever for the town, that features the saffron crocus being surrounded by a wall, which is walled in. But I think that, in fairness, the Walden part already existed. I think the walled in theory is perhaps doesn't hold much water, so we shall we say. But so that's briefly how it got its name.
So let's rewind a little bit back. So let's talk about where saffron is from originally.
So actually, we think that saffron comes from, I guess you'd call it the Near East, or sort of your neck of the woods, really, Greece, sort of Turkey. There's been frescoes found on the island of Santorini in Akrotiri. Yeah. And they depict, there is a beautiful fresco. You can find pictures of it online. They depict these rather attractive young ladies picking what has been interpreted as the saffron crocus. which I'm sure we'll come on to in a moment about how it's harvested, but it's they're harvesting these flowers. There's also monkeys harvesting the flowers. But as I always say in my saffron presentations, I don't think monkeys are a reliable source of labour in this respect. So I wouldn't trust them personally, but especially with something as expensive as saffron. But anyway, that dates from, I think, about 3,500 BCE. So it goes back a long way, but that's where we think it originated. There is a particular type of crocus that saffron comes from, and it only comes from the Crocus sativus. No other crocus will produce saffron, even if it has slightly long stamens. It has to be that particular type of crocus. And it also only flowers in the autumn, which is often a surprise to people because we're coming into spring shortly, and hopefully we will have lots of beautiful crocuses coming up, but they won't be the saffron-producing crocuses.
Right. Yeah, that's true. So a flower from the Middle East and Mediterranean and kind of warm climates that blooms flowers in autumn, how does it work in England? I mean, how is it possible to be?
This is a thing that surprises people because obviously, I'm assuming where you've just talked about in Greece, that's probably quite warm and quite mild most of the year.
Yeah, summers, yeah.
And in La Mancha in Spain where it grows and Kashmir, and Iran, all of these areas are quite arid and quite warm. And then you look at Britain, you think, well, yes, I know nowadays with global warming, we have hot summers, but realistically, we're quite a wet, mild climate. It's not particularly, you wouldn't think, in conducive conditions to growing saffron. But it does grow here very well, and it's really the question about how it got here, because it's not naturalized to this country. It had to be brought here somehow. But it does grow here very, very successfully, and it certainly did in the past, and it's being done so again now.
I've heard about a few people around, and obviously on in your book as well, but I think, I don't remember where, maybe Cornwall?
It's grown down in Cornwall, and it's grown in Norfolk. It's even grown as far north as Cheshire. It's still grown in Essex, in and around Saffron Walden. The English Saffron Company do a good job of growing it there. It's grown even in Sussex, and I can assure you I've tried growing saffron in my garden and I'm on heavy clay and I've had no joy. The Sussex Saffron Company, it's grown in Suffolk as well and Kent. There's quite a number of companies out there now producing saffron in England.
Because we know the Iranian or the Spanish one that is one of the best quality, but obviously if you can grow it here and you can have it very source it locally, probably it's going to be as good, right?
Yeah, definitely. It's very good quality. I mean, people often sort of balk at the price because it is expensive, but it's, you know, realistically it should be expensive because it's it's not a crop that's easy to manipulate in respect of you. It has a very short growing season. It has to be harvested by hand, and that doesn't matter whether you're doing it in La Mancha or in Essex. It's the world over, it's harvested by hand, and then from the flowers you have to pick out the stamens, which are dried to become saffron, the spice. So it's a labour-intensive crop to produce. And I say it has a short season. There's not much they can do to extend the season. They are looking at things, I believe, modern saffron growers like hydroponics. But it's quite, it's quite tricksy in that respect. So that's why it's expensive. But it is worth, you know, I always say if you're buying cheap saffron, you have to ask yourself why it's cheap.
Why it's cheap, yeah. I mean, it was always very expensive. Let's talk about that. It was expensive from the get-go, wherever people used to trade it. It was an expensive, because always it was hand-picked. And also even now it's probably the most expensive spice in the world. Then I think the second to saffron is vanilla.
Yeah.
Another one that has been you can only hand-pollinate it in a sense. So yeah, things that they are so delicate, so small, and you hand-pick them or pollinate them and then you dry them and then they lose weight as well.
Absolutely.
That makes it expensive.
Yeah. So that's why it's expensive, but it's worth buying. Certainly. So yeah, it was grown. I mean, it was in the past grown all over the country. It wasn't just exclusively grown in East Anglia, which is where it's most renowned. So it was grown in Cambridgeshire, Norfolk, Suffolk, Essex, obviously. And a lot of it comes down to the soil you have. So it needs free draining soil. But even, I mean, I've just mentioned I can't grow it in Sussex. I've tried. But even in Sussex, I found records going back to the 16th century where it has been grown. So it was grown all over the place. And it was supposed that the Vale of the White Horse, which I think is Gloucestershire, was particularly renowned. William Harrison even said he, even though he was from Essex, he said it thought it was better from there than Essex. So it's, you know, it's had a history, a long history of being grown in this country.
Yeah, yeah. And historically speaking, the reasons for growing saffron here in England is obviously to use as a dye mainly, or do you think as a spice in food or medicine?
I would think the primary reason was initially medicine. So again, my research, I started really looking at, because I'm a culinary historian, I was looking at its use in food. So I was sort of looking from the medieval period onwards. And there's William Harrison again, puts the date of saffron production beginning, although I suspect it began earlier, between the end of the reign of Edward III and the beginning of the reign, end of the reign of Edward III and the end of the reign of Richard II. So that puts it between 1377 and 1400. So it's quite a small window. And that, of course, is a lot of that commerce in that period was influenced by the Black Death, which had occurred in the mid-14th century. And then there was an opportunity there because there were less people to feed to potentially experiment with different crops, such as growing saffron. So that's kind of where we get that idea. You know, we've got that sort of time frame to work from. But I suspect it was probably being grown at some level in monasteries, perhaps, before that date, primarily for medicine. But it has been used as a dye. I believe it's not my area of expertise, I have to say. I did say that quite clearly in my book. I'm like, don't ask me too many questions about dyeing. I don't really know, much about that sort of textiles and stuff. But I understand it has been used as a dye in the past. And of course, it was used because it was so expensive. And produces such a beautiful colour. It was used extensively in medieval cookery, which is where what sort of triggered my interest in it from a food perspective.
I'll be back with Sam Bilton and more stories about English saffron after this short break.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping. And that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, because it gives all this vibrant color in food. And
yeah,
we know that medieval and Tudor cooks liked the food to be very, very beautiful and ornate and all that stuff. So
absolutely.
I guess, yeah, the saffron has to be heavily used in that period. So you mentioned something about drinkable gold from Tudor period. Is that something like an elixir or medicine?
Well, yes. So this was there was a goldsmith's son called Francis Anthony. And in fairness to Francis Anthony, he did train as a doctor, but there seems to be some dispute over whether or not he was actually recognised as a physician. I'm not sure they took too kindly to this goldsmith's son coming along and training. I don't know why, but he, poor thing. He invented a potable gold, which he claimed had a various health benefits. It was, I mean, I believe, and he wasn't the only one. I've got a book from Lady Grace Mildmay, not an original. I've got a copy, obviously, but from the 16th century. And she talks about that she was quite into her medicines, and she talks about this drinkable gold. And it was supposed to be, I suppose you'd say, an elixir. It was, it had a variety of health properties that it could help everything from, apparently from prolonging your health, but just generally looking after your sort of your heart and just keeping you everything tickety-boo. And it's quite horrible when you read what they did. They basically dissolved it in sort of acid. And I mean, C.Ann Wilson says in her books, The Water of Life, that she, you know, it sounds pretty toxic. So I think the idea was you're supposed to have a few drops of this gold, because the problem with gold, of course, being a metal, it, you know, doctors knew that if you ate gold leaf, it comes out the same way it goes in. So there was obviously a desire to circumvent that and try and sort of enhance the properties of gold by making it dissolve. But you can only do that by using some pretty corrosive stuff. So I don't think anyone should, absolutely, that's one historical recipe people should definitely not try, or at least not consume if they do try to make it. But he made a fortune, apparently, from selling this. And he wrote entire books he wrote based around his theories about this drinkable gold. And I know in France, they actually dug up the body of one of Henry II's mistresses, Diane de Poitiers. And they think that she possibly died from drinking something similar to this, some drinkable gold, potable gold, which was being taken as a beauty treatment to keep her looking young and fresh, because she was 20 years older than the king. But yeah, so quite grim. Obviously, Mr. Anthony doesn't talk about the potential lethal side effects in his book. He's, as far as he's concerned, it's just great for you. But yeah.
Right. So it wasn't like we take a few strands of saffron and we dissolve them in water and we drink that with...
No, so when you go forward to the sort of later centuries, I think they obviously cottoned on perhaps that drinkable gold was one. It's probably not very easy to reproduce. You still need to get the gold, and that's even more expensive than saffron. And actually, I think it's Eliza Smith has a recipe for a golden cordial, which is coloured with saffron, but she puts gold leaf in it and you can shake it and you see all the gold shimmers. So that was sort of a way of circumventing the lethalness. That was just a distilled spirit, which happened to be coloured with saffron, and then added gold leaf to make it a bit like these gimmicky vodkas and things that you can get at Christmas time now.
Yeah. Far too many of them.
Yeah, indeed. So
the fashion of putting gold leaf, edible gold leaf in your food, it didn't happen with a Michelin star.
Oh gosh, no, that's been around. I mean, that even goes back to gingerbread used to be gilded in gold when it was just a posh confection and only the highest members of society were eating it. And obviously when you get further forward in history, they're using a copper and zinc alloy called Dutch gold, which is fake gold essentially. But yeah, it's gold has been used for centuries as a decoration, and because it's believed to have various health benefits.
So yeah, there was pretty much an extensive industry, let's say, in that time, trading saffron and producing, trading and consuming around England.
Yeah.
Was it exported at all? Do you know that? Or it was just enough about for English consumers?
Well, Sally Francis from Norfolk Saffron did some research here, and she ascertained that it was being exported from Norfolk. because they were producing an awful lot to the Netherlands. So it has been exported in the past. I'm not sure about now, but certainly in the past it has been. She found evidence to suggest that it had been exported because they were producing so much in that particular county.
Right. And that part of England has always had connections with the Dutch side and that side of Europe. Yeah,
absolutely. And also it's incredibly good for producing saffron. It's fantastic. It's got the right conditions. So very free-draining soil, quite a dry climate compared to the rest of the country. So it's always had that affinity with growing the spice, and it continues, probably one of the last areas I would think that where it died from, where the saffron production eventually died out.
So having a very expensive product like saffron, obviously there's always the danger of having adulterated product and the fake product. Was that quite common in the medieval and Tudor eras?
Yeah, so, I mean, obviously because it was expensive, people wanted to maximise their investment or, frankly, just rip off people. So there were various tricks that the saffron growers could employ. So it used to be dried, as you've indicated at the beginning of the podcast, that it was dried into sort of a cake, if you like. And once it was dried, it weighed less. So that one of the tricks was to, because it was sold by weight, was to either drip the cakes with candle wax or sometimes butter. But butter, obviously, with downside of that is, well, even candle wax potentially, I guess, because it would have been tallow, is that eventually it would go rancid. So that was something you had to watch out for. But also they would sometimes mix it with sow thistle or safflower, which is still known to this day as bastard saffron. And sometimes marigold petals, even dried meat fibres were used in the past.
Really
dehydrated meat. And the way you could test it is obviously if you went to dissolve it, obviously it would there would be no colour coming out of the saffron. But also once you put it in water, the meat would reconstitute. So, yeah, there were quite a few tricks in the chat. I think Harrison refers to them crafty jacks that were trying to rip off customers.
So obviously all this played a role into the price and the trade of saffron. But it was important for many centuries, I guess. What happened next? Why did it die down from the English farming, let's say?
Well, there's a lot of reasons, I guess. I mean, obviously the enclosure acts, various enclosure acts wouldn't have helped because they were getting rid of small tracts of land and bundling land together so to make larger farms. That certainly had an impact on it. But I think also taste changed as well. We were using spices less in food. I know they continue to be used in medicine, but even by the 19th century, there were doubts as to saffron's efficacy as a drug, if you like. And also it was just cheaper to import it from overseas. So, right. You know, at Spanish saffron, I think even in the 17th century was half the price of homegrown saffron. So it's always been cheap, I guess, because in the Spanish and the Iranians and other countries, even the Greeks could produce larger quantities of saffron, and therefore it was cheaper to than the stuff grown at home.
We just left with the name Saffron Walden.
But the last saffron the last saffron grower that we know of documented was a John Knox, and he actually lived in Duxford, which is, I think, in Cambridgeshire. It's only a hop, skip and a jump from Saffron Walden, but it's technically in Cambridgeshire. And he died in 1829, I believe. But, so he was the last documented saffron grower. That doesn't mean there weren't other saffron growers, but last documented saffron grower. And then, of course, it sort of died out completely, more or less, and then it's been revived at the end of the 20th century into this century, the 21st century, which is a good thing.
Yeah, of course. One of the questions I have is, I've seen a few recipes with saffron from Cornwall, basically. So what is the connection with Cornwall and what's the history here?
Okay, well, for some unknown reason, Cornwall is the only county, or the southwest of England, because I know some people in Devon will argue they also have saffron buns. But the southwest of England is the only part of the country that's retained this, a dish that contains saffron. So I did quite a lot of research. I tried to ascertain, I was really hoping to come across some old Essex recipe that contains saffron, but I couldn't find anything that you can categorically say is an Essex recipe that contains saffron. But the saffron bun was once eaten all over the country. I'm pretty sure of that because it was like a feast bun. It was a special occasion thing. But the Cornish have particularly sort of claimed it, I guess, as their own. And I think that's in part because of the legend they have about how saffron arrived in Cornwall. They believe that it arrived there with the Phoenicians. And so the story goes, there was a Phoenician called Himilco. And in 425 BCE, he was tasked with finding an alternative source of tin. Now, the Phoenicians had sort of an influence all across the Mediterranean. So they had outposts as far west as Cadiz in Spain, or Gades, as they used to call it. And he set sail he went north from there. And I think the idea was originally he was supposed to be heading for Brittany, but somehow ended up in Cornwall instead. And when he got there, he traded saffron for the Cornish tin. And that's how the Cornish ended up with saffron. That's the story. I mean, there's scant archaeological evidence to support this theory, unfortunately. But
absolutely.
But, you know, let's not ruin a good story with the truth. Oh, archaeology, bless them. But it's a nice story, but I suspect it's probably not the true story. But who knows? It might have done. I mean, it was certainly being grown in Spain by, I think, sort of the 8th, 9th century. And it did spread northwards from there. So it's not beyond the realms of possibility that if it was the Phoenicians that brought it somehow, indirectly, to Cornwall. But I suspect that's where it comes from. But there's lots of superstitions around So saffron buns, they were, you read accounts from Cornwall, where they were sometimes marked with a cross. Now, of course, we know of hot cross buns on Good Friday in England or in Britain in general, but they weren't always, they could be marked with a cross at all times of the year. One sort of a household account I read was that the ladies' aunt always didn't to ward off evil spirits. And then there was another theory that if you kept one of your hot cross buns, hot cross saffron buns, I'm going to add here, aside and left it all year round, if you grated a bit of it into the bowl of an invalid, it would cure illness. It doesn't specify which illness, but apparently it would cure
every
illness, anything you can imagine. It was a cure-all. But then, you know, I've heard a similar tale told of regular hot cross buns from my home county of Sussex. So, who knows? But yes, they do still make, you can still get lovely saffron buns in Cornwall if you're down there on your holidays or if you live down there. So seek them out because they're a beautiful thing.
I will do. Your book, obviously, a part of the history, it's also half of it has recipes with saffron, let's say, recipes with saffron. I guess that have been interesting to try and find which recipes to include and how the use of saffron in itself in the recipes. I mean, how did you go about that? Because it can be very tricky, you think, to find a recipe that is saffron, like has the saffron as a main ingredient.
Well, I mean, the thing about saffron is it is quite a potent spice. So one of the things I often get asked is how much is too much? Because some people really don't like the taste. They find it quite soapy, bitter sometimes. And I think I'm quite generous with my pinches of saffron. And I, you know, that's the other thing. How much is a pinch? It's a bit like how much is a handful? My pinch is not going to be the same as your pinch. So there is that to consider. But some recipes you read had horrendous amounts of saffron and I'm like, good grief, that would be horrid and very lurid as well. But anyway, that's an aside. How did I find the recipes? Well, it's actually because it was so made such beautiful colour, it was actually very widely used. So even in something like Blancmange, which is by its name, you'd think it was supposed to be white, is quite often coloured with saffron, bizarrely, even as it's basically means sort of white food.
Not very white.
It's not very white, no. Not always, but sometimes it's coloured with saffron. So I guess I did a search on a number of books, key books, and I cherry-picked the recipes that I thought would work or that I could adapt. One of the things I try to do, I always try to keep the essence of a dish.
Mm.
But obviously, as you know, sometimes recipes come with incredibly scant descriptions of how to cook them. So there's quite a lot of interpretation in my book, because I want them to be able to be used. It's a cookbook at the end of the day. There are recipes in the text to provide examples of how it was used, but the recipes that are in the book are recipes that are designed to be made by the people who buy the book and cooked in the kitchen. I want people to cook them at home. But the more recent they are, the more likely they are to be a verbatim recipe rather than, I think, probably the biggest liberty I took was there was a pigeon recipe. And I think it was a pigeon sort of hodgepodge. And I've turned that into almost a salad. Not almost, it is a salad. But I took the inspiration. There's a lot of the same flavours. It's just not... The other thing is a lot of things were cooked in a pot. There are a lot of pottages in history. And there's only so many pottages that people want in their daily life. So, yeah, that's what I've done. So I had to be quite strict in the end and say, well, I want this number of sort of recipes that are meat, this number of recipes that are sweet, this number of baking recipes. And that's sort of how I approached this particular project, because I could have written a lot more. And there were a lot of recipes I tested that didn't end up in the book. So
So there's an amount of historic recipes that were adapted.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then obviously some more modern ones.
Absolutely. But they all have most of them have got a seed of inspiration from a historic recipe. But if you, a good example of where I've literally just converted it is Sarah Harrison's saffron buns. And that I have just converted into modern weights and measures, obviously. And, you know, as I always say to people, I don't whisk egg whites for 8 hours. You know, I use my Kenwood or my freestanding mixer. So, you know, so other mixers are available. But but that particular recipe, the Sarah Harrison recipe, is as it would have been in the 18th century, except I tell you exactly how long to cook it for, which is very helpful, I think, in this day and age. So, yeah, and that's lovely, actually, because it's got coriander seeds in it. It's very different saffron bun to what we think of the fruited buns that you get in Cornwall now.
That sounds nice.
It's got coriander. It really is a very aromatic bun and not too sweet either. They make great bacon sandwiches, believe it or not.
It's happening.
Yeah, it's got to happen.
Next time I've got some time, it's happening.
They make absolutely superb bacon sandwiches. So, yeah.
Yeah. Obviously, you have some curries as well and some more Eastern recipes, like from India and Persia, I suppose, and all that stuff.
Yeah. So, I mean, a lot of medieval cuisine is highly spiced, as you know, and it has echoes of that sort of Middle Eastern flavours. So I did try also to mix up the eras, but of course, the further in history you go, or the nearer we come to the present day, the less saffron is being used as a savoury ingredient. It clings on in, you know, sweet dishes. So I've got a recipe book from 1915 that I think has got about five saffron cake recipes or variations on saffron cakes. This savoury stuff, it's really only sort of curries that you start to see saffron sort of by the end of the 19th century. It's not used very much, or like a Spanish dish, for example. It's not really used in English dishes at all by then.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, yeah, you have recipes from Greece, from Spain and from Iran and India that they are more contemporary, let's say, and they use saffron as a savoury ingredient. I like the one with the chicken and the hazelnut bread sauce. That's really interesting.
Yeah, so I think that's the recipe itself was, I think, 18th century. And I did, for the sauce, certainly was 18th century. I think originally it was supposed to go with pheasants. I think that was the suggestion to serve it with pheasant. But it goes very well with the roast chicken. And it should be said that a lot of recipes I've done with the sauce with saffron in as well, sometimes you can separate them. You don't have to serve them together. It was a space thing to sort of bundle things together like that chicken. And the glaze I did change the glaze because I did try the medieval glaze, but you don't get the crispy skin with the sort of traditional egg, not the way in a modern oven. You may well do if you baste it in front of on a spit like they used to, but certainly in a modern oven, I struggled to get that crisp skin. So I ditched the egg yolk in the base because that's what they used to do in medieval times. They used to endure roasts with a batter of egg yolk, saffron and usually ginger to make them super yellow and golden.
Golden, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it goes really well with chicken, I suppose. Something like a rice and stuff. Yeah, it goes really well. And there's another very nice one with milk and garlic and saffron, like marinated chicken thighs, I believe. That was really nice as well. Yeah, I think that works really well too.
Yeah, that is a lovely one. That is a medieval dish, and that is actually an example of one where with very basic instructions, I've tried to keep it, as far as I'm concerned, without literally cooking it over a fire, I've tried to keep it as faithful as possible. But the ingredients in that recipe does exist. I think it's from the former curry or 250th century cookbooks, but it's out there. Yeah, so that is a proper medieval recipe. And it's good. It has got quite a lot of garlic in. Perhaps not one for Valentine's Day if it's your first date, but
maybe not the first date, but no. If you both eat garlic, then
if you're both eating it, I guess it doesn't matter, does it?
Yeah, I love garlic.
I love garlic too. So something else I couldn't live without. I think garlic and cheese.
There we go, savory stuff. Yeah. Still savory. Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah.
Excellent. So basically, I guess, we kind of talked about some of the recipes in the book and which ones are kind of your favorite ones here too, right? You kind of mentioned the ones that you find more...
I mean, it's hard to pick one, but I say that, Sarah Harrison's saffron buns I'm particularly fond of because I think that was sort of one of those revelatory moments when I made them because I was like, oh my God, these are absolutely delicious. I've had caraway cake before, but I've never, and I put gingerbread in some of my gingerbread recipes are coriander, but I'd never have thought of coriander seed in that sort of context. Because again, it's quite, I think of it as being quite an exotic spice, but that was also, and still is grown here in Britain. In some parts.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's probably one of my recipes. But then, you know, if I think back to all of them, the chicken ones you've just mentioned, they're all lovely. I only put the nice ones in. I didn't put any of the horrible ones in. They obviously didn't see the light. They didn't see the light of day, clearly.
Could you imagine?
They're on the kitchen floor, so to speak. But, yeah. But...
Lovely. And what's the future of English saffron?
Well, it's being grown again in this country, and there's a number of producers as well, which is encouraging. I think, you know, providing people support these local industries, it should continue to thrive. As far as I know, most of it is being grown as a culinary ingredient. I don't think it's being used as a dye. I don't think that much, enough of it's being produced, but I couldn't swear to that. But yeah, they're doing well, all right, I believe. It's, you know, Britain has its challenges with its erratic weather. So it's, they're managing to survive all these foibles that are coming their way in terms of heat waves and droughts and then too much rain. But it's growing well. So, yeah, you've got companies all over the country that are growing it, even as far north as Cheshire.
Brilliant, brilliant. Thanks for that. Sam Bilton, thank you for coming to the podcast and thank you for all the fascinating aspects of English saffron.
No, you're welcome.
That you shared with us, yeah. So tell us, Saffron was your second book, Fool's Gold.
Yes, that was my second book.
And you have another one out now.
Yeah, so last year I published The Philosophy of Chocolate with the British Library. It's part of their Philosophy of series. So it's a very short book on the history of chocolate. It was quite a challenge to condense the history of chocolate from its discovery or its sort of early roots in Mesoamerica right up to the present day into 15,000 words. So it is a very much a snapshot of chocolate history, but it was great fun to write. So it's, I hope, you know, any listeners who want to buy it, I thoroughly recommend it. Or if you know someone who loves chocolate, it's definitely a book to give to someone who absolutely adores chocolate. So it's very easy to read. It's not too heavy.
Yeah, great. Fantastic. Thank you so much. And we can also tell the listeners that you have a podcast as well.
I do. I have a podcast called Comfortably Hungry, and each season I have a different theme. And this season I'm currently working on is, not surprisingly, on chocolate because of my book and because I did so much research and it was such an interesting subject and I couldn't get everything in the book. So this the podcast is my opportunity to cover some things in greater detail that perhaps weren't touched on in the final publication. And yeah, you can find that on all your usual sort of podcast platforms, Apple, Spotify, Google. And yeah, I hope everyone would like to listen to it. And at the end of it, I should say my guests bring a dish to a potluck supper. It's a virtual potluck supper. We don't actually get to eat them, unfortunately, because we do most of our recordings over Zoom. But it's quite fun. So by the end of the season, I have quite an eclectic variety of dishes for people to sample in theory.
Yeah.
And you can also subscribe to it via Substack. I've got a sort of newsletter that accompanies the podcast on Substack.
Brilliant. Thanks. Listeners, just tune in and find the podcast. It's really interesting. Both seasons, actually. Looking forward to listen to the new episodes about chocolate.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed this episode all about saffron. And it has inspired you to create some amazing recipes with it. It's a beautiful spice and goes really well with rice as well. So if you make some Persian rice, do include saffron. It's very expensive, I know, but also small amounts can do the job. And of course, it's worth its weight in gold. Please buy saffron from reputable sources and not get conned with cheap imitations and saffron that isn't actually saffron, and that will disappoint you even more. I've been Thomas Dinas, and this was the Delicious Legacy Podcast. Thanks for listening. See you soon.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.